Welcome to the Azure for Sports podcast, hosted by the Azure for Sports team at Microsoft.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Azure for Sports podcast. I'm Suzanne Tedrick, and as always, I'm joined by my Azure partner in crime, the one and the only Mr. John Flynn.
Hey, hello, Suzanne.
How's it going?
Good, good. I think I was having a conversation with someone the other day that's probably led to the summary that, thank goodness, it's the one and the only. There aren't any more of you. How's summer? We're in the dog days of summer. How's that going?
We are. We've had some pretty interesting weather. I unfortunately got a drenching yesterday from the monsoon-like weather, but it's gorgeous today. And I'm hoping it lasts for a very, very extended period of time.
Well, at least through the weekend, right? I can have another weekend without rain, for goodness sakes.
How about you?
It's going well. I will be slightly controversial, though. It seems as though we're talking about Azure for Sports weather podcast right now, is that I don't believe that it's actually summer. Right? We've had one tiny little heat wave here in the Northeast. There's been more rain than not. That we're getting down to temperatures in the 60s. I mean, this is diabolical. I've got a problem with it.
Well, so this leads into a perfect segue to introduce our next person, because I will tell you, John, that living in New York City, summer here is awesome in comparison to summers in Chicago. Oh. And so this leads into my introduction, and hopefully Ari can weigh in. But we are joined today by the head of evangelism for Databricks, Ari Kaplan. Ari, thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully you can weigh in about Chicago summers, because I don't think John quite understands the magnitude.
well, welcome. Thanks for having me join the Partners in Crime, as you describe. And
awesome.
Love talking about the weather. It actually is a cool sports use case, especially in Formula One.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And speaking of cool sports use cases, I think that I'm fanboying again, right? Because we are here with legitimate sports data analytics royalty, right? I'm going to go out on a limb to say that we are one of the founding fathers, the godfathers of sabermetrics. Ari Kaplan is on this show. Absolutely, absolutely fabergasted. Ari, welcome. And thank you so much for being a part of this, mate.
Well, quite an honor to have that introduction. Thanks. No, it's been an honor to be one of the earlier folks in sports analytics, and love to talk about, if you're interested in what it was like when there's only about four people that I know of that were employed by a team anywhere in the world, as far as we know. But yeah, great to be here.
Interested. We are definitely interested. So as I call you, the real Moneyball over here. So why don't we talk a little bit? Why don't we start there, right? So I know you and I have had the privilege, or privilege has been probably all mine, of having a couple of conversations in the past. And I know that you started out with the Cubs. As you're saying, there's like four people in the organization that cares about this data thing, right? And maybe it's cool. What did that look like when you entered the world of sports and data? How was that world? And then what did it morph into that led up to this sabermetrics moment that people started believing in data?
Great. And yeah, so I had two stints with the Cubs. One started as a consultant in 95, creating and heading up like their automation of their scouting information, and then becoming an actual major league scout. And then when the Ricketts family took over about 11 years ago, was their first of two hires to create and lead the analytics. But even before then, I really started with the Dodgers back in the late 80s. I was a student. I was just a teenager. Didn't know any better. But what I did know is that the statistics that were describing some of the players I liked weren't always the best. And conversely, some of the players that I didn't think were the best would have positive statistics. So just as an undergrad teenager, just instead of complaining about this, you're assigning luck to the value, let's not do that. Let's come up with something. In that case, it was called the letter X, which now is kind of pervasive, like expected goals in football, soccer, or expected runs. It was just like, what is the expected amount of something? in baseball runs or expected earned run average based on given the typical stadium or the typical defense behind you. You know, it's unfair if you're a pitcher and your defense would dive and catch all the balls, your results would be better than if you're in a team if the defense was not quite as good, or the relief pitchers that would follow you, that you have inherited runners that you leave on base, and they're completely, if they score, they're completely out of your hands. And if they score or not depends on your relievers and defenders. And that affects the statistics 10, 20, 30, and in some cases, 40% a year. So bottom line, I was able to say things, come up with better ways to do it. And then the GM at the time of the Dodgers, Fred Clare, not a typical career progression, but he saw me in some of the news outlets and looked me up in my dorm room at Caltech and just called me up. And my housemate said, "Hey, Ari, Fred Clare, the GM of the Dodgers, is on the line. Meet with you." So yeah, came in and I went from like fan person to like being in the dugout with Oral Hershiser and Eddie Murray and so many other great players, like within a few hours, and haven't looked back since. And then, yeah, started with the Dodgers, like really in the front office the year after, 2 years after that, actually. So the Baltimore Orioles with the ownership. And yeah, at that point, it was just myself and a handful of others. Eddie Epstein was with the Orioles. Bill James, I think people really know about. Pete Palmer, and I'm missing like one or two others, but that was it. And we all kind of knew each other, and it's cool to pick up the phone and Bill and Pete, give you some work that they've been working on, and I give them work I've been working on. And but at the time, what was really cool is those organizations, the Dodgers and the Orioles, the two I started out with, were really embracing any information that can help them win more, help them select players based on skill and not luck. So it was fortunate. Fred Clare, others, Roland Heeman, who's now in the Hall of Fame as a GM, was our GM. Frank Robinson, as a teenager, he was my boss, the Hall of Fame baseball player and manager of the Orioles. So they were really embracing it, and most other teams were not, but that was good for us. We had an advantage. So that's what it was like at the beginning.
Well, and what a beginning. I mean, just hearing some of the anecdotes about your journey. I mean, like so many people would just be so, so envious to be able to interact with all of these amazing teams. You know, just thinking about the Dodgers, I'm from Brooklyn, so I still remember them back in the day when they still were in New York. So it's amazing, the experiences and the wealth of knowledge that you've been able to help these teams understand, so that we're not just having a conversation about, oh, this person was lucky, it's just about luck, but to really quantify things so that people can have actionable insights as to what players to pick, where we should go, et cetera. And so if I could talk a little bit more about that, thinking about your work at Databricks. So if you could describe, you know, your role as the head of evangelism, what exactly does that entail? And then talk a little bit about how does Databricks help to contribute towards sports analytics and potentially the future of sports analytics?
Yeah, great. So my role, like head of evangelism, was a newly created role. It's funny name, but a lot of tech companies, I know Microsoft has a few of them. It's really to help educate, make awareness in the market. A lot of people don't know who Databricks is, or like where we play and what open source technology is, or what this terminology called the lakehouse. It's like an industry we started. Like, what is it? Why is it important? Could be everything from talking on podcasts like this, or going to conferences, or doing social media posts, trying to talk with influencers and educate them, or analyst firms, you know, Forrester, Gartner types. But then we have this whole ecosystem of partners like Microsoft and others. And how are we better together? So my role is that, plus just trying to say things easily to like a higher level, like an executive suite, who may not be super technical. Databricks, really fun company. It's doing really well. And our founders are like legends in open source software. If you've heard of Apache Spark, MLflow, Delta Lake, these combined, they have a couple hundred million downloads of this open source every single month. But, you know, very technical. We have a grassroots techie movement. If you know notepads, you know Scala, R, Python, stuff like that, you fit right in. But a lot of times, you know, the high level, like what is data? What is AI? What are pipelines? Why do I even care to do something faster? That's where I hope to try to explain things. So that's my role. And then you're asking about Databricks and the fit into sports. And, you know, kind of want to, you know, just explain Databricks, that whole lakehouse terminology that I came up with is it's now not Databricks specific. It's a whole industry. It really talks about the combination of traditional data warehousing, which is like business intelligence, what happened in the past, structured data, think like Oracle databases. I used to work for Oracle, president of the worldwide Oracle user group in the past. So that's structured data warehouse. Then you have data lakes, which is unstructured video, image, text, stuff like that, streaming data, where you do data science. And very incompatible systems. You need two vendors, one to handle the descriptive, one to handle the predictive, forward-looking, unstructured data. And so that was a problem. And Databricks came up with the lakehouse. Founded on open source technology. Now you have like one platform. All of your data is in one place. Usually you have to pick two of the three following: cost. How do you lower cost? How do you improve speed? And how do you keep it simple? And you usually can only pick one or two of them, but we have all three. And that, as a result, we've been growing really quickly, which I'm glad since I was able to join 8 months ago in this new role. But yeah, revenue has been getting adopted really well. And so that's what Databricks does. And as a result, really, general purpose platform on one hand, anyone who has data, anyone who wants to do artificial intelligence, makes you able to scale things, not just in millions of rows or billions of rows, but now trillions of rows. That's like the new paradigm. It's pretty wild. Faster than ever before. We have some nice plays on generative AI, acquired company Mosaic ML for over $1 billion a couple of weeks ago, I think. And so it's the general platform. So all sports teams, the progressive ones especially, are looking to ingest and mesh together this data pipeline, unstructured, structured data, streaming data is big, and make insights. So think of us as kind of like the plumbing to make that happen. But on top of that, there are sports and entertainment specific things. We have solution accelerators, which are kind of like pre-created notebooks or models. It gets you like most of the time 80% of the way there. And then you jump on it and make modifications like customer churn or looking at athletic performance. So there are some things that are specific to the sports industry.
That's awesome. And it's incredible to think that we now consider trillions of rows for the data nerds out there as something that's just a thing now, right? I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. Actually, on that, I want to take you back to being a kid at Caltech. And if you had the access to the tools that are available today, Databricks, the other open source community products, some of the closed source community products as well, how would that have, I don't want to say accelerated, right? But how would that have differed the path to getting to where you wanted to be? Because you saw that gap, the X, right? Your expected X in whatever sport discipline you're in. How much easier is it for someone sitting in a dorm room in Caltech this year versus when you were sitting there to do something as groundbreaking and as career changing as what you did in a college dorm room?
Yeah, it's so much easier these days. You know, there was no Python or R back then. And those have these packages that all these third-party people or companies have developed that, like, if I wanted to do regression, like I had to research it and figure out how do I do it? Do I write my own program in machine learning? But now they're like these packages that just make the data processing faster. The data collection is much easier, like cleaning data, had to do all that by hand. And it was, so I would say 80% of my time was just getting data and collecting it into a format. I used this product called Paradox that people probably have never heard of. And during one of my speeches to the Caltech Board of Trustees, Ben Rosen, who's the founder of Paradox, Borland at the time, was at the speech. I was a poor college student, so he gave me a free license. So he helped get this whole Moneyball thing started. He later sold his company to Hewlett-Packard and became president of HP at one point. But that was like 80% of my time was doing something that could be done in like a second these days. The other challenge back then is like we didn't have the mass amounts of data. So it was like much sparser, smaller sizes of data. So it's almost like overpowering what you have today.
Yeah, data is no longer the scarce resource that it was. Or even so, we're seeing a lot of use cases now where composite data sets are being created to fill a gap or a deeper dive into a prediction. Right? We don't have data on that because it hasn't happened yet. But if we did, let's create a composite data set and go ahead. So I want to go back to Moneyball because I just can't help myself. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm just fanboying. So apologies in advance here, right? Most of us have seen the movie that work in the sports industry, right? I would say all. And if you haven't, seriously, go. Mm-hmm. Right. And I love the premise, and I love the fact that it's based on reality and it's a world that all three of us live in on a daily basis, right? But why do you think, in your opinion, it isn't the gold standard across every league globally for how you look for talent, evaluate talent, and change your roster based upon statistical analysis versus how much you paid for them or how many followers they have on Instagram, et cetera? What are your thoughts around that, Ari?
Yeah, you know, great question. And yet one of the main areas it started was with baseball. And, you know, it wasn't even nearly as smooth as what the movie had shown. You know, there's a lot of cultural resistance, like well beyond. But over time, you could show, like, if you shift in baseball, not even like near my beginning, but when I started with the Cubs around 2010, only 3% of balls in play were shifted on the infield, meaning the defenders physically move to a different area. Even though the numbers for many batters would say, if you stand here, the ball will be hit there 80%. And if you stand there, it'll be 20%. So it was like on the ground, clearly obvious, and people still would resist. There's a great book, Big Data Baseball, about the Pittsburgh Pirates. My good friend Clint Hurdle, even though he as a manager supported it, the players would naturally be resistant, or they would approve it. And then 1 out of 10 times the ball would be where it would have if they were traditional. And the human bias, like not bias in a bad way, but just, you know, the way the human mind works is it kind of unravels everything, like superstition. But in baseball, there's some cases where it's pretty clear and obvious to get an advantage. And what are the strengths, weaknesses, and habits of your opponent? And then other sports, I just think it's a combination of cultural resistance that, you know, go for it on 1 yard or 2 yards in football, which the Eagles started doing and they win the Super Bowl. But yeah, I don't know, maybe it's more that it's a team sport more so than baseball, and that you have patterns in basketball. It's not just an individual except on a free throw. But it could also be that the way that analytics are presented is it's more like trivia of what happened in the past versus something where an athlete, that Curry, can take and understand, you know, like in football, like a great stat that I helped work on, and now I think it's more mainstream, is when you throw a pass to somebody, do they catch it more with their left or right hand, the receiver? And if you're defending them, you know which side of the body to try to tackle or strip the ball before they even catch it. So those are some of those examples.
I can see where cultural bias kind of comes in, where there's still not this, like, I can't. Like, and I won't. You just resist for all intents and purposes. There was something you said a little while ago that really intrigued me, and that was talking about the fact that there's a proliferation of tools when it comes to data analysis now. So when you were talking about the Jupyter notebooks and Spark and like all of these other things, it's like clearly you know your stuff, absolutely. But it just shows the breadth and the depth of data tools that are available to us right now. And on top of that, as you said, the proliferation of data. We have so much data now to look at and consume. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts when it comes to artificial intelligence, when it comes to our current set of tools. How do you think AI will help, enhance, harm? What are your thoughts on the impact of AI on existing tool sets and what that might look like in the future?
Yeah, so I love the whole generative AI. When I was in fifth grade, I wrote a computer program that would write poems. And then you could select, you know, John and I were talking about, you know, ZZ Top, Zeppelin, and Pink Floyd and stuff. You could do it in the style of what you want, but it was just a computer program that was kind of simple. But now generative AI can have billions or trillions of parameters and generate content. And it's just getting started. It's really like last November, things happened. So, you know, already I see really great applications, but 1, 2, 3 years from now, you know, it's going to be so much more advanced. But like in sports, you have scouts that write subjective reports. This player was deceptive, but on the other hand, he lacked this ability, but his attitude was great, but he was a little slow in his bat speed. And generative AI can say, all right, you're seeing these good and bad things. Just tell me, what does the scout think on a sentiment analysis on a scale of 1 to 10? And it's tuned to the lexicon, to the jargon of the industry, in this case, scouting reports or injury information. So that's generative AI to kind of process the sentiment of unstructured type of information. But then in terms of like the tooling, you know, Databricks has incorporated just in the last couple of weeks, like into our tools, the ability, like you're writing code and you could like do a select statement, select, then in parentheses and in quotes, use the AI. What were our sales weekly basis over the last year, and add in US holidays and visualize it in English, and it'll do it. And, you know, we're like one of the leaders in that, but I think pretty much every software vendor out there is going to do something similar. So as you program, like Copilot, if you're familiar with some of those tools where suggestions pop up, they're only going to get, you know, like autofill it started with, you're typing in a SQL statement and it fills in the table name. Then it got more complex and it fills in like help buttons and everything. It'll now like do suggestions based on what your coworker code did. So on one hand, I think everyone's going to be elevated a little bit. The simple code that people are doing is going to be automated. And then I think instead of everybody losing their job, you're going to be elevated. So like everyone is going to be a manager level where you're managing like AI bots that write the code, and you're like the, instead of a manager of humans, you're writing, managing the bots, but you're still the human. And that I think will be proliferated in pretty much every single tool out there as like the next co-pilot.
Yeah, I agree with that. I had the fortunate occasion to be on a podcast yesterday by Hype Sports, and they asked us as an ending question, I was on with colleagues from the industry, and they said, well, where do you see AI in the next 3 years? Right. And the prediction that I made was the largest programming language in the world will be English, right? Mm. Coding will be a thing of the past. We will write in natural language, and then the bot, the AI, the wrong name for it, will then create the output of code, which we will see as an application as we've dreamt up using natural language, right? So turning coding into poetry almost, right? The more creative that you are with your prompts, the more creative that you are with your inputs to an AI engine, the more beautiful your application, the more performant it will be, the more what, et cetera, right? So I think that plays in quite nicely to what you're saying right there. And I fully agree that we are going to have a collection of co-pilots, of AI bots helping us do our best work, right? Versus replacing us and doing it for us. But that does lead me to a question, because you have been a scout, and I'll put a little leader into a question later. You've also been a musical scout, but we're going to talk about that one a little bit later. You've been a professional scout for sports. Where we see the biggest uptake by far of all sports teams coming to us is to talk about scouting, right? And is to talk about do what they do today, but at machine speed, and find those diamonds in the rough, find those that would have normally not passed a gut check, find those athletes that predominantly good today, but will they be in 3 years, right? We don't know. Where's that predictive element? Where do you see those two worlds, Ari, combining, where you have a scout and you have a scouting application, which is made up of multiple computational variables, data, et cetera? How do you see the coexistence of that?
Yeah, I love that thought. And I loved your earlier, you know, discussion of English, the next SDK, so to speak.
Yes.
But yeah, so I've been a major league scout, a lot of players, you know, success, you know, a lot of good claim to fame of recommending people getting called to the majors or converting people from relievers into starters, helping out with trades, some of them in the Hall of Fame. And in some cases, it was like pure analytics. Some cases, it was like pure scouting. And some, it was a mix. And, you know, it's a good question, since, you know, in the end, in this case, it's actual humans and athletes. So it's like a question of, you know, based on what you see now, they could be a 16-year-old kid at that time. What might they do 10 years from now or 20 years from now? And like predictive analytics is similar to the way scouts think in a way. So predictive analytics saying what features or variables are most important for like the future success, like will they make the majors? And then for scouts, it's the same thing. They're saying what players are similar. So you might see a scout say, this player reminds me of Duke Snyder. Suzanne, to think of a old Dodger, you know, so I, you know, here's the five players they're most similar to. When I saw Duke when he was 16, he was like him. So they're trying to make similarity scores based on what they've seen. That's not easy to do. I've been blessed to have many mentors along the way. Jerry Krause sadly passed away. He was the guy that was like known for being Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen's boss, but the GM of the Bulls when they won 6 championships. People don't realize he's won 3 championships with the Oakland A's, and in Chicago, he took me on at like as my one of my mentors. We had have more dinners with him than my wife in many summers, but he, you know, was great. Hundreds of hours of conversations of what he would look for. And any time that it was quantifiable, I'd write a program to capture that. So like he would say, I'd notice, you know, if you have this characteristic and you can throw this velocity with this type of command, or if you start your pitch low and then subsequent pitches go upwards, you tend to be a better pitcher over the long run. So those things you could quantify, and then other things he would talk and just you can't quantify it. But yeah, it's a combination, similar to like the music. It's like, yeah. So we can get to that in a minute. But yeah, with scouting, it's understanding what variables can you quantify and then tasking the scouts. Like, so scouts have evolved a bit where the teams are asking them to evaluate players on metrics that make sense versus metrics that have no predictive value that we've seen. And then in addition to it, write like a summary paragraph. And now we can use that for a text analysis and generative AI to pull out if there are certain keywords or phrases. Maybe that mathematically is more predictive.
I agree with that. And so I think obviously you're being very humble, right? Let's talk about Mr. Rizzo for a second. About the World Cup, I mean the World Series, right? But I'm gonna do it. I can't resist. I'm gonna have to get into the music right now. I think where it's number one, scouting for a baseball player or scouting for a musician, right? You're both looking for an outcome that's going to create a market out of that player, whether it's a positional player, whether it's a band player or a solo artist, for example. You're looking for both of those to become something valuable and something more valuable than they would be if you hadn't put them into the situation that they're in. Where do those similarities lay, Ari, between a musician and an athlete?
Yeah, well, musicians are really hard to quantify. I know music companies, Sony and Paramount and others, and Disney. For a movie, it seems to be a little bit easier. Like, when do you release it? What genre is kind of popular? Do you add a celebrity? And how does that kind of work? What other movies might be coming out? Musicians are a little bit funky. You might be able to say like what genre of music might be more successful than the other, but it's really hard. That in music, still you probably need that talent scout, since there's like some it factor that I don't know how you quantify. You just kind of see their energy level. And there, like if you have a songwriter, you know, like Madonna didn't really write her own songs. I met her songwriter, or seeing the play Jersey Boys, like having a songwriter to match his voice, the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli, like that, you know, see someone with the voice, see someone who said, I can work with them. You get a winning success. That's really hard to quantify mathematically. So I don't have an answer to that.
That's for sure. Some things are harder to quantify, like why we tend to gravitate towards artists and some acts versus others. For those of you that are familiar with me and my husband, he's into K-pop. Ooh. And to this day, I am still baffled, but he loves it, he enjoys it, so that's all that matters. Awesome. I'm gonna switch over the question and talk a little bit more about fan engagement. So mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot on this podcast is really about it's never been a better time to be a fan, as the one and only John Flynn has said multiple times. So thinking about Databricks, the analysis that's being offered, the tools that are out there and the tools that are to come, how do you see this affecting fan engagement? Do you think that these are things that bolster how fans feel when they're engaging with their teams? Are there some additional opportunities that we can take in the future? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so the whole suite of use cases, and you know, a lot of that is on the fan experience, fan engagement. There's like your traditional stuff, like how do you segment your customers, which is really across every industry, like retail, CPG, and entertainment. How do you market your messaging to the individual person versus aggregating them into like five buckets and sending a general email? So with artificial intelligence and generative AI, you can make these customized messaging that, you know, the fan likes better, since it's actually the content that they want. You know, we know you like, your husband likes K-pop. Let's do a K-pop with a Brooklyn Nets night or something. And then, you know, another person could be personalized to them more directly. So this hyper-personalization can get a big lift in revenue, but arguably more important, the fans are like, it resonates with the fans more. They feel more happy and engaged. So that's kind of traditional marketing, but then there's experiences like at the event itself. And the stream case right now in Vegas, they have that sphere. If you haven't seen it, you know, go look it up. It's wild. It's this like giant, super high res inside and out haptic seats that shake to the music or to the event that's inside, surround video, surround audio. You know, the one thing they still need to improve are like concessions. People don't want to leave their seat for 30 minutes and miss a quarter of the game to get something. So I think, you know, better delivery of food and memorabilia and clothing and stuff will be there. So that's like at the stadium. I think fans are more statistically minded these days, so teams have been providing more analytical interpretations. You go to Formula One race and the information they provide kind of keeps you understanding what's happening in the game when it's like out of your field of view. But then, you know, at the at-home experience, one thing is you want to, like the World Cup, they've been experimenting with different camera angles that as a fan, you can either wear virtual reality goggles and see it for real surrounded, or just like they can use AI to make it appear like you're the actual player on the field. And it's overlapping the actual image of Lionel Messi or Mbappe or others. So it feels like you're in the action. And they're going to be doing more and more on that. Wired magazine had a great article of the NBA, who also happened to be on the Databricks platform and Azure. But how do they, you know, manage all of this pipeline and streaming real-time data so that the fans have better engagement? So it's starting, it's partway there, but in coming years, it's going to get much more enriched experiences.
Yeah, totally. I really agree with that. And I think, I mean, so we have a lot of conversations, sometimes cumulatively as Microsoft and Databricks in the room and they're better together story. And sometimes individually that lends to a sort of a joint solution here is the word engagement, right? So we find fan engagement, the teams that pay attention to treating the fan as an individual, whether they are in the building or outside of the building for reasons, maybe they're international viewers or maybe they can't get to the game or whatever it is, but providing that experience for them that engages them, mm-hmm. right? Fan experience isn't just providing data overlays onto a screen or a second screen experience. It's providing data overlays on a screen and a second screen experience that counts to me, that I care about, that John the Nets mm-hmm. fan or John the Jets fan wants to have at his fingertips, at his disposal. And I often, as Suzanne correctly says, right, I said, there's never been a better time to be a sports fan, because together, like companies like ours are always on a quest to make that engagement better. Mm-hmm. And that's phenomenal, right? I absolutely love it. I think it's one of my favorite things. And I equate that to some of the things that you've said publicly in the past and we've discussed around feature engineering, right? Understanding my habits, the habitual the things that I do when I watch a game or the things that I do that lead up to watch a game, not all of them touch traditional sports data, right? Some of them may be transportation data. Some of them may be food and bev data, maybe hotels, maybe flights, et cetera, getting into that. How do you see the culmination of bringing all disparate data sources into a common data lake or lake house, if you would, and then provide a differentiated experience to that fan? Do you see that as becoming more and more of a thing that clubs are going to be used to get the fan experience right?
Yeah, absolutely. So sports and entertainment in general and gaming industry, all of that is just now, you know, through the lake house, which helps enable streaming data, and then the processing of trillions of records of information in sub-seconds, which is crazy to think. The ingestion and synthesizing of all the variety of information was pretty much impossible before at this scale, but now it's possible. And then, you know, you could do traditionally, like Nielsen would have and other marketing analytics firms, path to purchase, like what you're saying, not in addition to what led up to it, like what order. Did they see a billboard? Then did they do a social media post? And then Mr. Beast, who, if you don't know, is a popular YouTuber, did some stunt. And then they went to the website of the Yankees and then they bought something. Then they waited 2 months. Like all of that could gear up the right message, the right offering at the right time. And the fans love it better. And it's not just like pricing offerings. It's like engaging that with them two ways. Social media is a great outlet for fans to engage going in, you know, but there are other ways. And I think we'll be finding now that there's AI for, you know, generative videos and stuff, you know, fans to just like talking into their phone or showing videos, you know, the chance that a player might see it and react. You know, how cool is that? It'll just keep increasing the engagement and the fun and, you know, with entertainment, like the Taylor Swift phenomenon, just on social media. It's not just her concerts, but the social around it, like everyone sharing their experiences, or K-pop concerts I'm not as familiar with, but you know, that's all part of the entertainment. And then like with Databricks, I've had the pleasure to go out to the gaming developer conference, which is like esports, video games, and you know, some of our customers, Riot Games and Supercell and many others, you know, Minecraft, Microsoft. You know, as you start the game, how do you get matched with a player that is going to be fun to play with? And that is, you know, fan engagement as well. The better matches, you're going to keep coming and playing the game again and again, since it's going to be a more fun environment. And then on the downside, how do you reduce like toxicity? I worked for the Phillies. I don't, you know, their fans were unique, so to speak, but you know, they would like to curse a lot or bully other people. Not when I'm picking on them. I love them. But you know, it's one of those things. And in video games too, you play Among Us and you have little kids with adults cursing or, you know, making it uncomfortable or sexist, et cetera. How do you do that in real time? And that's kind of where, like what we're talking about, analytics and people, you have the analytics detect what could be toxic. And then you have a human moderator that the AI is feeding in the, you know, the potential violators. So I kind of see that with fan engagement of AI automating the positive and negative, and then like a human moderator hired by the team to promote, hey, we have a super fan who did XYZ. Let's show it to the player before the game. You know, something like that.
You know, it's funny. My husband and I recently attended the Crosstown series with the Yankees and the Mets. And so I would be curious if we can find the analysis of who is the more potty mouthed fan. I'm not going to out myself, but it's probably a Yankees fan. All I'd say, those, I mean, honestly, I mean, being able to have that level of insight so that we can get deeper connections with our fans, it is something that is tremendous for teams and for many people. And just, in my opinion, I think it just really makes the fan even more engaged. So it's wonderful that we're able to do that. Ari, thank you so much for your time. I do have one last question for you before we close up. And it's really to talk about, you have such an illustrious career. You have such illustrious experience that, again, would make anyone envious on so many levels. And so thinking, and including present company, apparently, but thinking about that, how does your personal experiences and your background, how do you use that when you are, when you're doing your day-to-day role into Databricks? What are you bringing from that personal into what you do your day-to-day?
Yeah, and thank you for those compliments. I don't know if the color, I'm blushing a little bit, but I know there's so many different learnings out there. Well, number one, people are still super excited of sports as the analogy. People like it. You know, taking myself out of it, if you have some interesting experience, people want to hear about your experiences arguably as much, if not more, than the technology for like inspiration, use cases. So I feel like a lot of what has been accomplished in sports analytics really applies to every industry in some ways, you know, finance, retail, manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera, government sector, education, that, you know, there are lessons learned. There's the technology, there's being innovative. Many companies have cultural challenges of people wanting to not change. And I do understand, if, you know, I wouldn't want to change unless I see good evidence of reason why. So I don't always advocate change just since it sounds fun and you want to be different. That, you know, there could be some foundational knowledge to keep doing things the way you're doing it. But, you know, where it's absolutely proven, you stand here 80%, you know, chance that you will be successful, stand there 20%. That is the type of stuff that, you know, you need to break down culture. And then teamwork, you know, we're all humans, you know, and sports is by and large, a team effort. So how do you do collaboration? How does everyone work together? So those are the things. And then I've been a practitioner too. I, you know, created the Cubs and Dodgers and Orioles and others as a one-person show before hiring a team. You know, but I have the hands-on experience. So when I speak, you know, I talk about the successes and challenges, and I can feel in my heart, you know, like the challenges and frustrations, like that earlier on question you had, like, how hard was it? How easy is it? What would you do to make things easier? So I just like hope to transfer some of my experience to help others. And sports is a great conduit.
It is indeed. And your experiences are vast. And I think that you do have the world's most interesting man title as the sort of subsection of the business card there. But no, I'm not joking, but I thank you so much for being here and giving us some of your time, right? I mean, we have to have you on again because I haven't even touched on Eddie Vedder yet. So that's a teaser for the next episode. Now you're on the hook. You have to, right? So, but thank you so much. The time that you spend with the clubs and the teams out there and the stuff that we've done together is indicative of the work that you've done. But the one thing that I find magical about you, Ari, is that you take your historical experiences and data and you find a way to frame them into a future thinking when relevant to your point. Change for change's sake is pointless, but change where it makes sense and where it matters. You draw on your deep well of expertise and you have a grounding in that is leading with authenticity, and it is awesome to see. And again, thank you so much for being on the show, mate. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate that. This is like humbling. I feel like I'm on Mr. Holland's Opus, if that was the movie. Yeah, like, so nice. Appreciate it. And thanks. I love your shows as well. And what you're doing with Microsoft is so cool.
Oh, thank you. And of course, you know, I've got to double down on the love here. No, Ari, I've loved this conversation. And I think one of the things that resonated the most, especially when you were talking about your experiences and bringing those into the workplace, you made it human. And I think sometimes when we talk about technology, especially, you know, the latest and the greatest in change, we fail to make these human connections. Sports is very much a part of the human connection and having those relationships. And the same thing with technology. Technology for technology's sake is, you know, what's the point? You want to have meaningful change and the power to change and impact lives and in a positive way. And so I just felt that coming through in everything that you said. So thank you. Thank you for that.
I appreciate that. So nice of you.
Awesome. Well, everyone, thank you. That brings us to the close of our episode, but we will have more episodes in the future. Please let us know if there are any topics that you would like to hear about, as well as your feedback on any of our previous episodes. Until then, take care. Have a great day.
Thank you.